Good evening, everyone. Thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio at 89.1 FM on the dial and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Tom Lounges, the host of Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. Tonight, Dennis DeYoung will be joining me by phone to discuss his two newest solo band releases. That's right, two new albums, 26 East Volume 1 and 26 East Volume 2, both on Frontier Records. They're the first new project from Dennis since 2009's 100 Years From Now. Dennis, who famously wrote and sang the song Best of Times with his former band, has certainly picked the worst of times, perhaps, to release new music. We'll find out all about it after this. Good evening, and thank you for listening to Lakeshore Public Radio on the dial at 89.1 FM and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This is Midwest Beats, a program all about music and the people who make it. I'm Tom Lounges, your host, and tonight, Dennis DeYoung, a Chicago icon, will be joining me by phone in just a few minutes. We'll be discussing Dennis's two newest solo albums, 26 East Volume 1 and 26 East Volume 2, both released worldwide on Frontier Records. Now, these are the first new projects since Dennis released 100 Years From Now back in 2009. Now, he famously wrote and sang a tune called Best of Times. And now it seems like he's got some two great new albums, but these are the worst of times to release new music, or are they? We'll find out the method to his madness and what he's been doing and what he plans to do with these albums in just a few minutes. So let's start off by giving you some brand new Dennis DeYoung. You know, back in February 1964, America was glued to the television. Ed Sullivan was on, and four mop tops out of Liverpool named the Beatles were performing. Dennis DeYoung was one of the many young men that were watching that saying, hey, I might want to do that someday. And he has. Dennis was very influenced by the Beatles, and the latest album, Volume 2 of 26 East, has a cover that reminds everyone of the Meet the Beatles album with the face that's half in shadow, half in light, and the opening track is kind of an homage. Well, it is definitely an homage to that young lad in Roseland who was watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. It's got a lot of name-dropping of songs. Give it a listen. New music kicking off Volume 2 and this show. This is Hello, Goodbye, Dennis DeYoung.
I watched it all from my front room door. In the winter of my discontent, four lamps on in heaven sent. Singing, yeah, yeah, and girls wearing shriek. Yeah, 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 yeah. Who's 8 days a weekend? Ooh, ooh. Singing, yeah, yeah, it was all so exciting. Yeah, 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 it was
Hello, Goodbye. That is brand new music, Dennis DeYoung off 26 East Volume 2. Because Volume 1, we haven't gotten to yet. We'll get to something off that a little bit later. Dennis DeYoung is an icon of Chicago. He's been around forever. And I thought that was a perfect way to open the show. Because back in February of 1964, Dennis was one of the young men all across America, myself included, that was watching Ed Sullivan and seeing the Beatles for the first time and saying, hey, maybe I can do that. Maybe the girls will scream for me. And all these years later, many screams, many concerts, many albums, Dennis is still making music and paying homage to his heroes from Liverpool with that one. Like I told you, listen to the lyrics and you'll hear a lot of references to the Beatles songs, titles, and even the guitar hooks. Good stuff there. Dennis DeYoung, are you with us?
Is this the one and the only Tom Lounger?
It's true. It is.
How are you?
I'm doing great, man. It's been too long since we talked.
I can't remember the last time. When was the last time?
It was in 2017.
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah. It's always good to hear from you. Ladies and gentlemen, in case you don't know, Tom has been a supporter both of Dick's and of me personally as far back as I can remember. He's one of the good guys. He always does his homework. He's always prepared. And he's just a wonderful guy. Now, Tom, did I say all that right?
Yes, you did. I'll send you the check.
Okay, thanks.
The one thing you forgot is I always spell your name right.
That's right. capital J-O-N-G.
There you go. We have a lot to talk about, and only less than an hour now. So let's jump into this. Well, last time I talked to you, you said that you weren't going to make any more albums. You had put out 100 Years From Now in 2009, and we talked again a few years after that came out. And I said, Dennis, it's about time. And you said, I think that was one of the best albums I've ever made, and I don't think people want to hear any more from me. They want to hear the hits. And, of course, you deliver the hits in your live shows, 70-some shows a year pre-COVID. But now you're back, not with one but two albums. And I know Jim Peterik had a lot to do with that. So let's give the listeners a little Reader's Digest version of how you got back in the saddle, so to speak.
Well, I live in a gated community. And Jim Peterik lives three blocks from here, which is the reason I live here. We need Jim showing up. So we've known each other for years, and he called me up one day and said that he thought that the world needed my music. I said, you're right. I said, have the world text me. He's on Frontiers Records. I did a double CD, live a DVD of a live show I did in L.A. called Dennis DeYoung Live with the music of Styx. Mm-hmm. And so they released that. It was a beautiful package. It was Serafino, the president of the record company, who has an especially a lovely relationship he and I have. And he's a great guy. And then he, right after that, this is the truth, Tom, he said, I want you to make a new studio album. And it's like, 2016? I don't even remember. But I said, Serafino, why? Why would I do that? Because, Tom, look, Cliff's notes. Music business is a shambles, and
right.
Particularly for people of my age, it's the same for all musicians. It's been completely and totally turned upside down by technology, and not in a good way. So I just didn't feel the need to do it. And of course, Jim and Serafino know each other, and
right.
I think they talked, and Serafino used to try to convince Dennis. He tried. I wasn't interested. And finally, he said, "Then I'm going to send you a song. Let's see if you can help me finish it." So he sent me a song, and I thought, that's pretty good, but not convinced. And then he was over in Italy, and he sent me a song called Run for the Roses in its infancy, but there was something so, I thought, powerful there that I just decided that I wanted to be involved. And so we sat down, two old Southsiders, similar background, similar senses of humor. I'm better looking, but don't mention that to Tom. I went over to his house and we started writing, and it couldn't have been easier. It couldn't have been more cooperative. You know, we're old guys,
right.
And the fire of youth has been replaced by wisdom and slow motion. So we got together and we started writing songs. It was easy. He would play bits and pieces of things he'd never finished, and I'd do the same for him. And we'd identify in each other what we thought were the best ideas. And we proceeded from there, and we wrote 8 songs really quickly. But then we started on the task of demoing them. He has a studio. Mine was down at the time. So we did a lot of work there, and both of us were on tour. And there was no pressure. Although Serafino said, "I want to sign you to a deal," I said, "No, because there's no sense of making music and having albums unless you have songs. You have to have songs. That's the first and foremost thing. That's what I preach from day one with all my colleagues and kids. Was this is not about tight satin pants, you know, or the length of your hair. This is about songs, because that's what people will hold on to for the rest of their life if you get it right." So finally, we wrote enough songs, 8 between us, and another, 11, 12, that I wrote by myself, and I thought I had enough. So I went and signed the record deal, and that was going to be 1 album, Tom. That's it. Don't want to do anymore. And I told the record company to pick the ones they liked, and they said they wanted them all. And I said, "You can't have them all. They're not going to fit." And so it was their idea to make it into Volume 1 and Volume 2 because they couldn't think of anything more pretentious. So, I wanted to call it Dennis Dion, this one and that one. But they said, "No, that's no good." So the title of 26 East comes from my boyhood home in Roseland on the south side of Chicago, where John Chuck and I first hooked up in my parents' basement and formed what would become the nucleus of Styx. And they divided into 2 albums, and that's what happened. And if there are any lies in there, let me know.
Now, you and Jim had teamed up, if I recall right, maybe 15 to 20 years ago and tried to write together, and the magic wasn't there. Why did it click now at this point?
I think because we walked into a room and tried to do note 1. That's hard. You know, we looked at each other, and we were trying to create a song, but we didn't go, "What ideas do you have?" We went, "Let's go. Oh, there's a chord." You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And we apparently we are not Lennon and McCartney. We're Peterick and DeYoung, and there that says it all. So it didn't go well, and so that was that. I just thought, we're friends. I'll sing on a thing if he wants me to sing, but as far as writing, it doesn't make sense. This time, we didn't do it that way. We'd learned our lesson.
Now, with the first time I heard you were back was when I heard the World Stage Project. Jim came to my record store, and he performed, and he brought albums for signing and things, and Proof of Heaven was on there with World Stage. And I thought, oh, my God, that's Dennis. And he was laughing. He goes, "Yeah, we got together and wrote this." And he said that you had written several songs together. Was that the impetus to when that song came out on record, had you already recorded your albums, or was that the thing that led to your albums?
No, Proof of Heaven was supposed to be one of the songs on Volume 1. And he had the World Stage album, and he wanted me to participate in making that record. And I said, "Great." He gave me a song, and I thought, no, I didn't like it that much. And so I said to him, "What about Proof of Heaven? We wrote that together." And he said, "Are you kidding me? Are you going to give me that song for my album?" And then he tried to kiss me on the lips, which I stopped. And that was even before COVID. So that's it. I said, "Here, you take it. I'll finish it here, and I'll mix it, and you can have it." And mm-hmm. That's how it happened, because that really was one of his favorites of the ones we've written. And for me, I thought, it's okay. I like it. I like it a lot. So I thought, let's give it to Jim for World Stage. That's how it happened.
Now, you guys did a music video for that as well, and it had been a while since you'd done a music video, but you looked very happy in that video with the two of you performing that song. What was it like to get back into the video realm again?
It's awful. They invented HD. I'm in my 70s. Who needs that? I mean, why didn't they have HD when I was 26? I was quite handsome. So, look, he said, "Would you do the video?" Okay, fine. So I show up, And we're going to do it like a, you know, what do they call them? A performance video.
Okay.
And so my guitar player, August, who played on the record and sang on it, he was in town. And so I says, I'll bring him. So August stands up, plays in my my live band. So we walked in, and we did the whole thing in 4 hours. 4 hours is what it was. But we started, and because it's Jim's album, and I'm really singing the song. Jim is not really, you know, he's not really that noticeable, except for in a couple parts.
Right.
I didn't want the video to be me standing in front of Jim Peterick. And so I came up with immediately, I says, look, this is about two old guys having fun. That's it. What am I going to do? Try to be somebody we're not? That's not going to pass the smell test. You know, they're going to look at that and say, oh, let's pose like this. You know, oh, come on, please. You know, so younger people get away with posing better than old people. You know, old people start posing, they just look like they're already dead because they're not moving. So I had the idea, it's a tool. You know, for most of the video, it's me and he and I standing next to each other. And just, I said, this is just, we got to exude one thing. We're doing this for fun. You know, remember, Jim? Like when we did it for fun before we signed record deals and everything got so damn serious.
Right. Now, you had mentioned to me before that when I said, well, Dennis, when are you going to make a new album? When we were talking about the 100-year project. And you said, I don't write songs for me. I write them for audiences. And at my age and with the changing in music, I don't think people want to hear new stuff. They want to come in here, Come Sail Away and Babe and all that. Have you changed your mind on that a little bit? Because these albums have done very well at a time when music is not doing well. With COVID, everything's shut down. Yet these albums have gotten a lot of great press, great reviews. I've sold a lot of them at my store, so I know people are digging it.
No, it hasn't changed my theory one bit. People who listen to rock and roll music, by and large, I'm not going to talk about any subset of a subset of a subset like you. You're in deep, and you have people you probably know who are just as deep as you are.
Right.
I couldn't make a living trying to sell records to you on concert tickets. You follow what I'm saying?
Right.
They ain't enough of you. I'm trying to find, you know, the broader audience. But those people are all old, for the most part. And I don't think a lot of Billie Eilish followers want my record. That's just, I'm just guessing, okay?
Uh-huh.
Although I'm considering green hair. Nonetheless, so my thought process is simple. People love the music of their youth. When they're forming opinions about themselves, mm-hmm. about the world they live in, and trying to understand how they fit in their adolescent mind, which we all know are not very reliable, and trying to understand what they like, what they don't like, that music carried with them for the rest of their lives. That's the music they will always remember as the fondest and the greatest music of their life. This is not about years, Dick. This is how people are. And so for me to go and say, oh, okay, I'm making new music, but to go to a concert and take one of the, listen, let's face it, without bragging, we got 14, 15, 6 songs that should be played every time you come and walk in the door to see me or them.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
I agree, yes.
You got to play them because millions love them, not hundreds, millions. So I owe that audience that walks in the building to pay me to play and offer me the privilege of doing that at 73 and 74 years old. I owe them, I have a responsibility to give them what it is they want. Not a bait and switch. If I drop in one or two, that's different. But I am not taking one of the really big songs that they love, replace it with something I'm doing now that will never in a million years have the meaning and the power of music that I made years ago. I am not that egocentric to believe that. Now, there will be an audience, small, Tom, it's small, that will go out and buy these things, or mm-hmm. few of them, whatever's convenient for you. How am I going to stop it? And,
right.
And so consequently, I just think it's baloney. It's like the people say vinyl's coming back. I said, those same people are probably buying a stock in Blacksmith. Don't do that, because vinyl is not going to really come back. It's just not. It's a niche for a small group of people, you know, who want to participate in that. Once again, you're not going to pay your mortgage on the people who buy vinyl. It's not going to happen. So I'm a realist. I'd like to believe that it's 1980. Tommy!
I don't know, because we are selling a lot of vinyl, and we have sold a fair amount of your vinyl as well. We are seeing it come back. It'll never be like it was. I know that. But I've got two record stores that sell 90% vinyl over CDs. You know, our biggest competition is the digital files, of course.
That's because you're a record store, Tom. People are going to grab. It's like saying, you know what? I sell gasoline. You can't believe how many people showed up to buy it. That's what you're saying to me. You have a record store. You can't be shocked by people who came in there. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
You're seeing the diehards. They're coming to see you. All right. But if you go online and you look at streaming and the this, Amazon, whatever, wherever they, you know, like I say, wherever fine records are stolen, this is where people are going to get this music. So I don't denigrate people who like vinyl.
Uh-huh.
I said, don't put it in your portfolio. I mean, this is pure, it's simple math. And I believe in math. And I am not in the business, nor have I ever been, into trying to reach the smallest amount of people. When I was the guy who was kind of saying to my very esteemed, very talented bandmates, let's go that way, which I did. I did it based on the fact that I thought with three different songwriters, three different singers, we could offer such a broad array of music
right
to an audience. I'm going to say this again. Babe, Renegade, Mr. Roboto. Is that the same band? I don't think so.
Completely different styles and approaches and everything.
I could go on. I have a list I just made up today where I put three songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't sound, and these are the hits we had. They just don't sound like the same band. And you know what, Tom? That's the thing that gives me the greatest amount of pleasure. Because in my own small way, on a much smaller basis, it's like saying, here's She Loves You, Something, and I Am the Walrus. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Doesn't sound like it's the same guy.
No, not at all. And I think that your career has, you know, in some ways as a songwriter, paralleled that, because you can rock, you can do the classical, you can do the prog, you can do the love songs, just like the Beatles and certain bands of that ilk did. You're not a one-trick pony. And on this latest album, one of the songs that really stood out for me, and one that I have played a lot on all of my radio stations, because I'm not only with NPR, but I also do other stuff, is The Last Guitar Hero, which, of course, blends the 70s with the 90s, because you got fellow Illinoisan Tom Morello from Libertyville playing. And now that's a different song for you completely, but yet it's still Dennis. You can hear it.
I think... Jim and I wrote that. That is the song of our two-volume set here that is the most collaborative. There is no... A lot of those other songs, either he had more to do with it than me,
mm-hmm.
or I had more to do with the song than he did. On that, that's as 50-50 as you can get. And I thought that, okay, if I'm going to make a six-life album, there would be a song like that.
Mm-hmm.
Either sung probably, not always, but by Tommy or J.Y. And so Jim came up with the riff, and he had this idea for The Last Guitar Hero, but his lyrics were, they were more autobiographical, about musicians specifically. And I said, Jim, I think there's a bigger concept at play here as to what technology does to all of us. And the fear we all have to be aware of, which goes simply like this. What happens when machines take your job? And, you know, this is what's happening to musicians. the way music is made these days is so non-organic.
Right.
I didn't say bad, but non-organic and contrived and manipulated by machines. You can be perfectly in time, perfectly in tune. You can manipulate waveforms in such a way that you can, you know, like you can hear, like I saw this one time, you have Dan Rather doing the news and he's actually singing Mary Had a Little Lamb. This is what you can do. You see, I mean, when it gets to that point, you don't know whether, you don't know what to do. But for me, The Last Guitar Hero is about, right? I thought it was only going to come for those guys. It's come for me now.
Right.
And here's the story on Tom. I met him at an Adam Sandler Christmas party that I played some years ago. Did I just name drop enough? I think I did. So he came up to me, but August Adler brought him up to me. He said, Tom Morello, I'd like to meet you. Well, I know who he was. My son's 40. Follow my son, he's 41, actually. So there was the Rage Against the Machine in my house. And that wasn't just my wife trying to hit me with something. It was really something going on. So I knew who it was. I remember saying, what do you think of this, Dad? I said, you know, I like singers. This guy talks. I said, but whoever the keyboard player is, he's amazing. He said, that's a guitar. I said, what? So I call him the Great Houdini. Anyway, Tom came up and said he'd seen Paradise Theater.
Okay.
And Kilroy at the Rosemont. And he had been a fan. He loved a lot of stuff. I mean, let's face it. You know,
he loved Kiss.
Right. That was his favorite band growing up. And, you know, so I said, well, this is very cool. Who knew? And so when it came time to play on the song, I said to Jimmy, I said, you know, this Morella guy, he's totally unique. And I think, you know, he might be the last guitar hero. The last guy who's done something that's truly different from everybody else. So I reluctantly sent him, asked him if he would be interested. He said, send me the song. And I sent it to him. He said, I love it. I'll do it. He sent it. I mixed it. You've got it in your hand. You played it on a radio station. This is just wonderful, isn't it?
It is. It's an amazing song. It's almost like a time zone. You blend the two decades together in such a way that you can hear the Rage sound. You definitely hear the Dennis sound and the melodies and the harmonies. It's perhaps the most standout song of the second album. And actually, it was the first album that was on. No, it was the second album.
It's on the second.
On the second.
This is what happens when you make two of them.
Yeah.
Who the hell knows?
And you put them all out at the same time, and they're all wonderful. So I'm going to play a little bit of that for our listeners. And just hang out with me for a moment. We're going to play this.
Sure.
The Last Guitar Hero, featuring Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, written by Dennis and Jim, and featuring Dennis on the vocals. Listen to this, and we'll be right back.
A one, a two, a you know what to do.
The music plays for free tonight from the corporate parasites living off the blood of their creator. The player stands there all alone, shreds his fingers to the bone. Everywhere he looks, nothing but traitor. Whatever skill that you possess, the new machine makes you second best. They're working hard, you know it's true. They're finding out to replace you.
The last guitar hero,
with the tools of your trade.
The last guitar hero,
so genuine, handmade.
The last guitar hero,
with your big old Marshall stack. Gone like a record star, never coming back. Hell, you ain't never coming back. We heard that change is here to stay. Hell, that's what they said yesterday. But who can tell which way the wind is blowing? We're traveling at the speed of light. We're nothing more than bits and bytes. Does anybody know where this thing's going?
trade.
The last guitar hero.
And piano friend.
The last guitar hero.
So cool, dressed in black. Gone like a dinosaur and never coming.
Hey!
He ain't never coming back.
At the last guitar hero, I wanted to get into that solo in there. That is Tom Morello, a.k.a. the Great Houdini, teaming up there with Dennis DeYoung. That's off the 26 East Volume 2, not to be confused with Volume 1. We're going to get to a song from that when we say goodbye tonight. What a great mashup of styles and songs, and yet it works so well. So, you can't say... You know, performers of my age and audience, because that works right there. You and Tom are of different generations. I was telling Jose, my engineer, it's like you got Jim Peterick, who really got big in the 60s. You got Dennis, who got huge in the 70s. You got Tom Morello, who was a monster in the 90s. And you're all in the same room with the same song. And it's magic, Dennis. It's magic.
Well, I appreciate that. The thing is, they've been kicking around these three chords for like 75, 80 years, haven't they?
Yeah.
So, what was true in the beginning, it's really true now. You're not gonna suddenly reinvent the wheel when it comes to rock and roll. My claim has always been about like 1970, all the real rock styles have been determined, and nothing new has ever been done. It's just other people come along and they put their spin on things. And I think that's a truism. So the fact that Tom and I and Jim could make this happen, I think it's just because if you get the song right, you know, you got something. Like I said, and the song is, you know, it's cool enough. And mm-hmm. There was Morello. You know, I said, Tommy, come in here and make this cooler. He did.
He did a great job. It'd be great if you guys could team up on some stuff again. And that lends me to say, again, my original question was, in the beginning, you told me that 100 Years From Now was one of your favorite albums, and I would have to stand by that as well as far as your solo career. But you didn't think you'd record another album. Now you have done two. You've given us 22 new songs. Are these the end, or... is this just getting the juices flowing again? Are we going to hear more from you?
If you put $500,000 in an envelope and send it to me. No, Tom, come on. Here's the thing for me. I'm 74, okay? There is no real upside to any of this. For me, if songwriting or making records becomes a test as to whether I know how to make records and still write songs and sing them, I'm not interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable enough in my own skin to say, I think I know how to do this. And if you listen to, if you're a rock fan of what Six did and what I did, if you listen to 100 Years From Now and these two, I think it gives you a great perspective on who I was and who I am as a singer-songwriter. And I think it's time. Look, the kids, I mean, you know, God bless these kids that are trying to be rock and roll stars. It's like, if you think it was hard for us, it's worse for them. Because the whole doggone system has been corrupted completely and totally through technology. And I don't need to be part of it anymore. And that's, I think I've done and said what I need to say. Did I think I'd ever say that? I think I said it back in 2009.
Right.
And then Peter, you know that purple hair he has?
Yep.
Yeah, that's because he's a magician. he casts a spell on me. He hypnotized me. So, I'm out of it now, and that's enough for me.
Well,
that doesn't mean I'm not going to, if the Cootie ever allows it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Cootie 19. Both of my albums came out during pandemic.
Right.
Both of them. And I've not been able to tour.
Right.
And so it's a great benefit to go on the road, play the music, play a couple tracks, remind people that you're still alive, all good stuff. I haven't had the opportunity to do that. And I'm waiting, Tom, because we all know right now, as I said with all due respect, that rocker from the last volume one, that video starts where you see breaking news. This just in. Nobody knows nothing. This has been my promise since 2007 when I put that in a song called "Oh Dear." I still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I don't know how to defeat an incoming call. Honey, call our son and tell him don't to call no. Okay. So anyway, nobody knows nothing. Human beings are so filled, and this is what's wrong right now. I'm going to give you a quick tirade here.
Okay.
And catch me if I fall off my soapbox. I could break a hip. I could break a hip. So here it goes. Nobody knows nothing. Human beings, we need to trick ourselves and delude ourselves into thinking that this universe is at our beck and call. No, it is not. Okay? And because we all know, as human beings, things that animals don't know. We know we're going to die.
Right.
No wonder dogs are so happy. They wouldn't be that happy, okay, if they know what we know. So when it comes down to it, I look at it and I think, how about this, human beings? How about a couple things? Number one, there's only one rule, huh? That's the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
If we could just do that, humanity would be much better off.
The world
That's
would be
all
better,
we have
yeah.
to start there. We don't have to do big things. Make everybody who is of a different religious belief, political belief, of racial, ethnic, all that stuff. It just start there, small. Okay, treat the other guy the way you want to be treated. Simple. And number two, less hubris and more humility. If this COVID hasn't taught us that, and I look around this world and so do you, think, what's wrong with people? They've become the biggest group of jackwagons on the planet. I believe they have.
I do too. Yeah, it's only getting worse the last couple of years.
They keep saying and doing things that are contrary to any logic, as far as I'm concerned. And this is not picking a side here, okay? Because we can look at both sides and say, what? Are you with me? What did you just say? What did you just think, right?
Yep.
So I guess that's why I wrote The Isle of Misanthrope, which is on volume two.
Volume two, right.
And I started to think, have we all become, has this country become the island of misanthropes? Now, for those people who don't know, a misanthrope is literally somebody who hates humanity. So he's a human being that doesn't like people. And I started to think, listen to all these people talk and shoot their mouths off and scream at the top of their lungs at each other and this one and that one. I thought, have we become a species that ultimately figures out a way to hate somebody that's human? And that's what it seems to me. So once again, boys and girls, if you're listening to me, and if you haven't already turned this off and said, who needs this old fart telling us what to think? I say to you, golden rule, and admit we don't know enough. The simplest thing, like the virus, the vaccine, the whatever it is, right?
Right.
We're scratching the surface. Science and a universe is so big, it's incomprehensible to human beings in its entirety. We should admit that and say, let's give ourselves all a break, please, and say, we don't know. It's okay to say that. We don't know. And I'm always very skeptical of all those religious, political, your sports writers, the rock critics. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The people who claim they know.
Right. Because nobody knows anything.
Nobody knows nothing. That's what it's got to be. except me. I got it all under control.
Careful, you're going to fall off that soapbox.
Oh, my, wait a minute, honey. Put a mattress down. I almost cracked the
tooth. One of the things that a lot of your fans know you for as well is the theatrical side of you. You've always had a theatrical flair with your music, of course, but, you know, you played Pilot in Jesus Christ Superstar. You wrote Hunchback of Notre Dame. I know you staged it a few times. You released the soundtrack. Are you done with that? Because it seems like it never got the life it should have had.
Well, here's the first thing. It's going to close the Skylight Theater in Milwaukee. It's going to close their season in June next year, God willing, and the creek don't leak. It was supposed to open the season last fall. And then that thing, what is it called? Yeah, that got in the way. But here's the thing. I would have never been involved in any theater if Tommy Shaw hadn't quit the band in 1983. The only reason I ever did anything was because he quit. And when he quit, he quit on all of us. Nobody else quit the band.
Mm-hmm.
And we were left holding the bag. And the other three guys wanted me to replace Tommy. On the spot, they were so mad. Because let's face it, you remember Six in 1983? They didn't suck. They,
right.
They had a lot of people buying their records and coming to their concerts. So Tommy took off for his own self-interest to pursue a solo career. Fine. But the other guys wanted me to replace him and go on the road the next year and do a stadium tour in 84. And I said, replace Tommy in Styx? I didn't think it was wise. So I, rather than try to do that and have that burden of responsibility, I made Desert Moon. I never wanted to be a solo artist. And if Tommy had stayed in the band, I would have never done anything but Broadway. I only did it because there was nothing else to do.
Okay. I never knew that.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. We had a comeback record without Tom because he went on the damn Yankees. In 90, we were supposed to get back together. It didn't work out. And he joined damn Yankees. So, we made a record without him.
Edge of the Century, I remember that. Glenn Burtnick did a great job, though.
Yeah, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make a record with Tom.
Yeah.
So we made the album. Okay, he had a hit record. All right, it went gold. But you know what? We did a tour, and it just didn't do well enough. And so I said, I stuck to my guns after that. I said, I'm waiting for Tommy to come back, because that's what people want. Am I wrong, Tom Lounger?
No, that's what they want.
Okay, and the story. You don't need to have any more excuses, alibis, right?
Right.
That's it. That's what they want. How do I know? Well, because 96 and 97, we came back, and the halls were filled everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So let me back up. After Edge of the Century in 92, we tried to, we did like 7, 8, 9 songs, demos to try to get a record deal. We just had a gold album, and I wrote Show Me the Way. There was a number 3. That's good. And so nobody would sign us to a record contract because grunge had taken over the music business. And
yep.
Held the grip on it for 5 years until Hootie came along. He went, "Hey, I got a blowfish over here," and then 20 million of those sold. You want to know why Hootie sold 20 million on that record? Because people were so sick of flannel.
Yeah, and okay? Doc Martens.
Flannel makes me itch. Anyway, so Hootie came back. Hey, melodic rock or whatever you want to call that. It's rock and roll with a singer and a song. Okay. That's what happened. So, in the interim, after 92, we couldn't get anybody to sign us to a record deal. My sister-in-law gets married. She marries a guy who's the executive producer of Jesus Christ Superstar, the 20th anniversary tour with Neely and Anderson and Irene Cara. I meet him at, didn't I ever tell you the story?
Not how you got involved. I mean, I did a lot of work with Ted Neely over the years, and
I know that
he loved having you in the production.
We've talked about that. Ted Neely. He taught me a great deal about being on stage in musical theater. But here's what happened. I go to the wedding. The guy I don't know, Warren Chandler, never met him. He comes up to me and says, I this is who I am, and I want you to be Pontius Pilate in this production. I said to Forbes, every 6 months or so, it's vital that you empty your bong water. So, but he was dead set on it, and he kept working on it. So I thought, this is nuts. So I called my buddy, you know him, Rick Colgan.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I said, Rick, this guy wants me to be in this thing. And I said, what's the worst that could happen? He said, you could be this. He says, last night, Jesus Christ Superstar was ruined by the presence of Dennis DeYoung as Pontius Pilate. So I thought, well, you know what I thought? I'm used to that. I hear that all the time. So I took the job. I didn't volunteer for that. It fell in my lap because my sister-in-law got married. Then, I'm going to dispel the sociological nonsense. Okay, about Broadway. Then the next thing that happened, I'm doing it at the Universal Amphitheater in L.A. Danny Goldberg from Atlantic Records, he sees it. He calls me up, Dennis. Danny, how are you? He used to manage me. He says, you were great. You want to make a Broadway album for Atlantic Records? I'm the head of, I'm the guy over there. And I said, is there money involved? So anyway, he said, yeah. So I did 10 on Broadway. Now, I'm on the road in Jesus Christ Superstar. True story. Does it have to be true? Maybe. It is true.
Close enough.
I'm in Fresno, and I'm in Superstar. I said, I wonder what it'd be like to write one of these things. Because if you haven't been told, when you're in a Broadway musical, you perform 8 shows a week.
Mm-hmm.
How many days in a week, Tom?
7.
See, that's wrong. it's against the laws of the universe. So I thought, maybe I don't want to be in this thing, but if I wrote one, I could stay home and then other people could do 8 shows a week, not me.
Right.
So I start writing the song. And then the day I began writing the music, there was a huge earthquake in Fresno. I was at the Hilton, and the building shook. And so then I wrote this musical because I wasn't in this. Got it. It was 93. And so I said, we got producers. Producers said, yeah, we love it. We want to do it. So what happened? They give me money. What's wrong with them? They gave me money and a lot of it. And they said, well, let's work on it. So 94, I'm working on it. There's a workshop. Listen, the only thing that moves slower than Broadway is a glacier, although I hear they're melting. Anyway, so 94, okay, and then all of a sudden, it's 95, I'm still working on it. We did a thing here, we did a thing there. All of a sudden, A&M says, we want to make a legitimate greatest hits album for the first time. We know we've done other stupid albums because we're a record company and we're stupid.
Now yeah.
We want a real one, and we want Lady. So I said, go to Wood Nixon. They own it. And they came back and said, they won't give us the right. I had this idea. I'll call up Tommy. He didn't play on it or sing on it. I'll ask him if he wants to do it. So I called him up. We got together at my house because I think Dan Yankees had just, they surrendered at Appomattox. I'm not sure. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that brought Tommy back in.
That was it. We went on TV to promote the greatest hits. People said, oh, all the promoters were like this. They can smell money. You could put it in. You could put it behind a brick wall, but the promoters smelled it.
Yeah.
And so we did the 96 and 97. So let me dispel this. If you want to break into Broadway, get a brother-in-law.
And go to a wedding.
Because I had nothing, everything I've done on Broadway.
Wow.
I never volunteered for any of it.
But you did a great job, and that 10 on Broadway, rather, was a really good album. It lent itself to your voice and your style. It was a good fit.
Yeah. I mean, I can sing that. I didn't think I could. That's the proudest album of my life because I sang things I didn't think I was capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't suck.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of room there to suck for suckage. I mean, you know, you could lay pipe for 6 miles. You know, that sewer water could wash all over you. Oh, big rock guy, you're going to come here and sing this stuff. Who does he think he is? So there you go. But anyway, no. The only theater I was ever interested in was stealing the theatrical ideas from rock, listening to theater, and putting him into a rock show.
Rock show.
And I just did a thing recently with Alice Cooper, the guitar player, one of his podcasts. And I blamed it on Alice Cooper. We were out on the road, and we were in Iowa, and he was playing there, and the promoter promoting Styx was promoting Alice. He said, "You got a day off, you want to come see Alice?" Okay. I went and I saw his show, and it was like an epiphany. I said it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, and it was theatrical from start to finish in ways I'd never even seen in most rock concerts. They're guys,
right,
standing there playing and singing. So After I saw how effective Alice was, I thought I'd try to bring all those elements I could into a Styx rock show, except for I drew the line at Cyclops.
Right, and hanging. So, well, Dennis, we're almost out of time here. I would love to have you back at your convenience. We have so much more to talk about, and you're fascinating. I've always enjoyed our conversations.
Well, why shouldn't I come back, for God's sake? That's if people actually pay attention. They might write in now after I'm off and go, don't have him back.
Well, they're not going to say that. I know that. I do want to close with something off the Volume 1, an interesting song that teamed. We opened with your homage to the Beatles, Hello, Goodbye. And we're going to close with To the Good Old Days, which features Julian Lennon on it. So we are going to play that as we say goodbye. Go to DennisDeYoung.com. And
no, don't do that. Don't do that.
No?
I don't ever pay attention to that. Go to my Facebook page, kid.
Okay.
I write everything on there, and I read everything that all your comments. I don't have any stooges or bots saying everything's great. It's me and it's my ideas, and I express to go there. The other thing is just for concerts.
Okay, very good, Dennis. It's been a pleasure, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, this is the To the Good Old Days off Volume 1. Dennis DeYoung has been my guest. Check him out on Facebook. And we'll talk to you again soon. I'll be back on Friday. Till then, adios. Stay safe. Stay warm. Well, it is warm. Stay dry. Bye-bye.
Come so very far, rising up against the odds to where we are today. Though there may be sadness, let's all raise a glass. Cheers to us and all that's past. Wishing somehow we could stay safe again, so safe again, in all our innocence. When we